subscribe and rate it.
5 stars.
Bigfoot and Beyond.
The greatest podcast.
Wherever you're listening or watching, remember always keep it squatchy, yeah.
And now your hosts, Cliff Berkman and James Bobo Fay.
Thanks to Next Evo for supporting our show. Try Next Evo Naturals, capsules, gummies, mints, and topical creams.
Get a better start to the year with products like their Stress CBD Complex. Go to nextevo.com/podcast and use promo code Bigfoot to get 20% off your first order of $40 or more. Hello, Bobo. How you doing today?
All right, what's going on, Cliff?
This, man, Q&A day. But I spent the day out in the woods. That was kind of neat. Nothing Bigfooty, but a friend of mine found really big mountain lion tracks in the snow. So I went out there and we were practicing snow casting today.
Oh, you know, because you sent me some photos. I was looking at my phone. Okay, so that was like wax you put down that wasn't blood?
No, that wasn't blood. No, for once I didn't use any blood in my cast. No, for once.
Oh, I thought you were casting like a bloody mountain lion print or something.
Oh, that would be way cooler. I shouldn't have told you. You could have lived in the delusion. That's way cooler than the actual reality. No, yeah, the brand of snow wax, forensic snow wax that I bought, it's on Amazon for like $18 or something, is they put pigment in it. So you can see the footprints on the snow.
That's smart.
Yeah, it is smart. I was impressed with that. Yeah, we gave that a shot today, cast about 10 of them. And I had to come home to do the podcast here because it's kind of a surprise podcast today in a way, just because we had some scheduling stuff going on. But yeah, so I'm looking forward to seeing how those turned out because I don't get a lot of opportunity to cast in the snow because I don't like snow.
Right. How did they turn out? Did you see them? Are they done all pulled out of the ground yet?
I don't know. We'll see. I played around with one a little bit when it was a little bit too green, frankly. And so I felt it kind of crack or say, oh, this isn't quite done yet. So I'm going to wait. But we got 10 of them in various conditions and even did a test run on one with no snow wax whatsoever just to see what that would turn out like.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, because it was pretty shallow snow. I mean, there's about 6 or 8 inches on the ground here, which is weird because Portland and Gresham and stuff, they got like 12 or 14 inches. We got less than they did for some reason. But it'll be interesting because there's the snow wasn't very thick. It's mostly on ice. And I'll tell you, man, it was a big mountain lion.
Cool.
Then we followed it for a while, but we realized, maybe this isn't – do you follow a mountain lion? I don't know. Maybe you do. Maybe you don't.
I think we had record snow here the last day and a half.
Yeah, on the coast, right?
Yeah, it dumped last. I mean, like, we went up to Trinidad, and we were the only people walking around. Like, we went to Trinidad Head and Patrick's Point State Park to do a little walking around hiking, and we didn't see anyone. It was like, man, this is killer out. It was like the surf was pumping huge. It was windy. Like, there was sleet and snow coming down, hail sideways. It was awesome.
Well, that's pretty neat, man. That is pretty neat. I'm going to be down there, actually, at the end of next month.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I'm going to be passing through. I think... Well, Melissa and I are going to take a few days to drive down, but a really good friend of mine died, unfortunately.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Tumbleweed. He died. So his service is on the 1st of April in Sebastopol. So we're going to be headed down there. We're going to take like maybe 2 or 3 days to get down there and just, you know, take a little bit of time for ourselves. Because too often, if I'm out of town, it's for work, you know. And even if Melissa is with me, which I prefer, there's no time to really do anything. So. We're looking at maybe staying up at Klamath one night, or we looked at those the elk cabins at the Redwoods. I'm not sure about that one because a little bit expensive, but we'll see.
Elk Meadow cabins are there. That's the best place you can stay. You might have a counter right where you're staying.
Yeah, we stayed there with the Animal Planet people.
Yep.
Yeah, that was good times. But Q&A day.
I'm ready.
It's my favorite podcast of the month. Not that I don't enjoy the other ones, of course, but I enjoy these because we don't know what's coming.
And it's easy scheduling.
It is easy scheduling. It's hard enough with both of our schedules, but when a guest is involved, it becomes more complicated.
Yeah. We're going to queue up the Q&A. We got a lot of voicemails. Last time we had a lot of written ones. This time it's going to be all voicemails.
Cue the Q&A. That's Q to the second power plus A.
Yep. All right, Cliff, take the first one.
All right, here we go. Here's the first voicemail. Let's hear it.
Hey, Cliff and Bobo. This is Tim Winter from North Carolina. Got an interesting either proposal or question. Since Bobo has several death reports, it might be good to see if you could get Paul McCartney on with you to share your experience about these fake I am dead reports. Anyhow, I think that would be cool if you could get him to be on your show. Keep it squatchy.
Bobo, do you have any connections to the Beatles at all? Can we make that happen?
A little bit. I know Sean Lennon's a fan, and Yoko.
They're fans?
Yeah, they used to watch the show.
No kidding. How'd you find that out?
Because my buddy plays guitar for the Sean Lennon band.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a connection, I guess.
Yeah, I guess Sean Lennon would know Paul McCartney. So I guess that'd be one, because Seahags plays guitar with them. So I call Seahag, then he, yeah, so only 2 degrees away.
Yeah, that's not that bad. I was thinking, the only way, like, I have a jam set, I go to a jam session where sometimes Michael Jackson's guitar player shows up, and I bet you she knows Paul McCartney or has played with him. I don't know. That seems like a long shot to me. So, Mr. Winter, Tim Winter here, I think it's a long shot. Although, I don't know, maybe there's something we can do with that. Well, how do we do this? Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney, I know you're listening out there somewhere. I know you're probably a big fan of Bigfoot and Beyond. We'll check the our Patreon to see if you're a member. If you are listening, feel free to reach out to us and suggest you as a guest. We're happy to have you on at any time. Big fan of your music. I think you're pretty brilliant. You have a wonderful pop sensibility. You're a great bass player. Why don't you come on the show? It'd be a lot of fun to have you. Well, you know, Mr. McCartney, if you are listening, we'll make it worth your while. We'll give you up to $75 for coming on the podcast.
I can't turn that down.
Yeah. Oh, you know what, Bubs? Let's go big, man. $100.
Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. Put a couple zeros behind that, huh? How do you like that, Mr. McCartney?
He likes it.
It'd be wonderful to have you. Big fan.
Okay, let's see what the second guy's got to say. Who's this?
Hey, Cliff and Bobo. My name is Rick Yarmy, and I am calling you from Ridgefield, Connecticut. I'm a huge fan of the podcast and have never missed an episode. My question to you is this. Did your parents and siblings share your belief in the existence of Sasquatch? And if so, what did they do to encourage you to continue your exploration and research in proving his existence and sharing your results with the world? Keep up the great work. You guys are amazing. Thank you.
I didn't really get much support from, well, my younger brother, he's into it, but he's not into it, but he knows they're around. And then my older brother, like, he gives it two thoughts.
Well, what did your parents think of it as you're growing up, as you developed this interest?
They weren't too encouraging.
No?
No. They were stoked when it became like a job making money on TV. They thought that was cool. But prior to that, it was a little embarrassing for them.
Well, they always seemed to be encouraging about it when I was around. I mean, because I knew you long before the TV show, and I knew your parents then as well. But they didn't shun me or anything like that.
They're just glad someone normal came over for once.
Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting I'm the most normal person in your life.
Yeah.
Doesn't bode well for you, man.
Or they were talking to their friends about, like, yeah. And then his friend's a school teacher. And he's the nicest guy. He was dressed normally and spoke well. And they're like talking about that like it was like a miracle.
Well, my envelope does look pretty plain from the outside, but the contents are a little abnormal. I'll say that. But, you know, my parents didn't. My brother doesn't really care. He thought it was super cool. I was on TV, and yeah, Bigfoot's, yeah, maybe they're real, maybe they're not. Cliff's a weird guy. Frankly, the Cliff's a weird guy perspective really pervaded the family perspective for a long time. But my parents didn't think much of it, honestly, until one summer. I was probably off with you, Bobes, because this is when I was teaching and I still live down in Long Beach. I was off doing my Bigfoot stuff during the summer, and I think my parents, they were very active in their church, you know, down there in Los Cotes Diagonal and Studebaker, where those two things come together. That's where they go to that's where they went to church down there. And they would sing in the choir, and that was like their social circles as well, you know, as it is for a lot of people. They go to church, and that it's a social thing. And they were out there one day, and one of their friends said, well, what's Cliff doing right now? And they said something to the effect of, well, he's out doing one of these Bigfoot things. And then one of their friends says, oh, I saw a Sasquatch once. And then my parents went, what? Especially my dad. But they went like, what? And she goes, oh yeah, I saw one up by the Trees of Mystery. I was walking on the side of the road. I saw it with my grandson and blah, blah, blah. And I interviewed her later about that. And sure enough, I believe she saw one. But my parents said, well, I've known you for 20 years or 15 or 20 years. She was married to a retired admiral from the Navy. And that's where the page turned, at least for my dad. My mom, I think it meant something to her too, but for my dad in particular, went from Cliff's a weird kid. I hope he has luck in his life and he can do something normal to, well, maybe Cliff's doing something that's actually kind of cool and of interest and maybe even important. Both my parents really encouraged me to do whatever I was interested in, no matter what the job, as long as I did it and loved it and was doing what I wanted to do, they were 100% behind me. And the fact that I was interested in science meant a lot to my dad. I mean, my dad he bought me my first telescope that I still have, like an 8-inch Meade Smith-Cassegrain telescope. It's out in the garage. So my dad was always very encouraging. And when he found out Sasquatches are real through his friend who had actually seen one, he was even more encouraging than before, which is a hard thing to do because my dad was a saint in lots and lots of ways.
Your parents are great.
Yeah, they were fantastic. I miss them tremendously. How about the next question?
Hey, Cliff and Bobo. Love the podcast. My name is Ryan from British Columbia. I wonder what your thoughts are on the supposed Jacko capture of Sasquatch near Yale, BC in the 1880s. Is there any truth to it, or do you think it's a complete hoax? Thanks.
I thought we went over that whole thing on the show with John Kirk about this BS.
Well, what do you think it is?
I don't think it's real. As much as it pains me to say, because it's one of my favorite stories of all time, it appears that it's not real at all.
Do you think it's not real because it was too fanciful or too weird? Or why do you think it's not real?
Because there was no other mentions of it. Like the conductor, you know, poo-pooed it later on. When John Kirk went and sussed it all out, it was total BS.
Yeah, I understand that a couple of the BC folks, John Kirk is one of them, maybe Steinberg or Murphy was along with them, I'm not sure. They came to the conclusion that this thing has to be fake. And I don't know what they based it on. I mean, maybe it's time to have John back and we could just talk about that too. That'd be kind of a fun episode, getting deep into the Jocko mythology. But I got to wonder if there was nothing to it. I mean, an awful lot of newspapers picked it up. And of course, that was much more common back in the 1880s. I don't know. I guess that multiple newspapers picking up it isn't necessarily pro or against the story. But if there was nothing to it, what was the basis? What was the seed of that? Because as far as just like random made-up journalism, why would it be an animal that does exist that is generally not thought of as existing? I know Krantz put a little bit of faith into it and tried to tie up some loose ends with this sort of thing. A quick look at Wikipedia. It's labeled the Jacko hoax. I read through it pretty quick here, but it doesn't say why it was proven to be a hoax. It just says that it was proven to be a hoax. And I got to wonder, like, well, why is the thing? That's what I would like to know, because this is one of those lingering things in Bigfoot. Is it or is not? We'll probably never know for sure, but a lot of people have made up their mind, which is okay. Maybe it probably is a hoax. That's the state of journalism in the late 1800s.
Yeah, they, in 1890s, they had lower faith in the press than they do nowadays.
Well, that's hard to believe. Are you sure?
Yeah. Isn't that nuts?
It is nuts. That is totally nuts. But I would still like to know why, you know, because, you know, I'll tell you the London tracks are a hoax. And when somebody asks me why, I'll tell you why. It's not just this gut feeling I have. There's actual factual reasons behind it. And too often I've heard that, oh, that's a hoax. And the whys have not panned out. Either they're kind of ethereal and hard to really pin down on an actual fact, or it's just false advertising, like in the case of Freeman, where Freeman admitted that his stuff was hoax. No, he didn't. That's false advertising. That's not true at all. So again, I'm more than willing to say, I'm not grabbing on saying, no, it's real. It's real. I'm saying, I don't know. But these people who do know, I would really like to know why.
Yeah, he'll break it down for you. When you go through the whole thing with him, it's like, no doubt that, yeah, that's BS.
Yeah, I'd like to find out a little bit more, mostly because it's such an intriguing case and it's part of the historic stuff, you know?
Yeah, we got to have him back.
Now, we had him on our episode, again, episode 43, if everybody wants to go back and listen. Didn't he also say that Albert Ostman is almost certainly a hoax?
Well, see, that's where I disagreed on that with him for sure.
Because his stuff then was the geography of the whole situation, I think.
Yeah, saying he saw, I could see the volcano from there and stuff. It was like, But everything else, his story checks out really well for me. And the, there was all kinds of things saying like why it was true too. Like other people saying, oh yeah, he told me that 20 years before.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to dig a little deeper in some of that stuff. And I know there's a whole book written on Jocko. Chris Murphy kind of dug the depths and produced a small little pamphlet about it. Not more than a pamphlet. It's a small book. It can't be more than like 60 or 80 pages. So it's one of those things. So I don't know if that helps at all, Ryan from BC. I hope it does. But, you know, what's interesting is that I know that the guys went out, the guys, and again, I think this is Steinberg, Murphy, and John Kirk, I think some or all of those people were there. They went out and actually found the train tunnel that all this supposedly happened at. So that kind of stuff checks out. These places do exist. And of course, Yale exists, and the description fits and all that sort of stuff. So it's a neat thing. Even if it's not real, it's a kind of a cool thing. And I know that if I'm next time I'm up in BC, I'd like to go see that particular tunnel. I think that'd be cool. I'd like to go see the Ruby Creek house.
It's gone.
Oh, I thought the house was still there.
I heard it was gone.
Oh, the cabin's gone. Okay, but the property's still there.
Yeah, the property's still there. And then that tunnel. Yeah, it's not easy to get to that tunnel. I think it was tunnel 4, wasn't it?
I don't know. I have my head 9, but I don't know. I could be wrong.
I can't remember the number. I just remember looking from up above. I was with the Fireball. We were driving out there, and it was way down. It was like all super gnarly, like broken up shale, like slidy rock, and it was way down the mountain. You have to access it. Walk from the west side, then walk along the tracks for quite a ways.
Yeah, I think they said it was like a couple mile walk along the railroad tracks to get there.
Yeah.
That reminds me of that Finding Bigfoot episode in North Carolina, I think.
Yeah,
the one where my brother was out with us, and you had who did you have? Is that
Bud?
Yeah, and it was so cold, and then Moneymaker wanted to walk through that train tunnel, and you guys walked through the train tunnel. He was like, "No, there's no train on these tracks. These have been abandoned for years." And not 20, 30 minutes later, a train comes barreling down the track. You guys would have been killed.
Well, the other thing was that what was crazy about it, the train coming through, was as it rumbled through, there was all those stalactites of ice hanging from the roof of the tunnel. And as the train rumbled through it and shook everything, all those big, heavy, like 3-4 foot icicles, just, you know, weighing like 30 pounds, all came dropping down from like 40 feet up, just like bombs just shattering everywhere. Like if we'd have been in there, we'd have been so, like we wouldn't have got hit by it, but all the falling icicles could have got us pretty good.
Oh man, can you imagine just being like 2 feet away from a train barreling at that speed? Like, because you would have to like hug the wall, but practically not to be bowled over by it. That would be horrifying.
That would have been gnarly. The best part of the movie is these tracks, he looked at them, kind of squinted his eyes and goes, "They haven't been used in 15 years or more."
Yeah, whoops. That's an important judgment to make at that point, I think.
Yeah. I looked at the tracks and decided it had been 15 years.
You know, of course, it'd been horrifying, that just the thought that you could have been inside there and stuff. And then you think, imagine the intensity of the infrasound generated by a train a foot and a half away from you.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that doesn't like make you crap your pants. Like, talk about the brown note, man. I don't know what would. Although it probably wouldn't be the infrasonic frequencies. It would just be the situation.
Well, I got stuck on a bridge trestle down at San Clemente, going down to trestles. On the actual train trestles, we had one of those Amtrak.
Is this a Bigfoot story time I'm smelling?
No. It just came by. We jumped down on the side, and my one buddy lost his surfboard because the
like the air pressure, like as it goes by, or
yeah, like it just sucked his board up out of his arms. If you weren't holding onto it tight, you could lose your board. His board got sucked away from him, got dinged up.
Yeah, trains are dangerous. So once again, Ryan, I hope we answered your question. I'm not so sure we did, but we absolutely spoke about it for a while. And sometimes that's the least we can do.
Or the most we can do.
Yeah, we may not be able to answer your question, but gosh darn it, we're going to talk about it for a while. That's something.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, Ryan.
Yeah, Cliff. You know, they say that stress is the new smoking. It's so damaging to your health.
Oh, yeah, man. It destroys your health. I mean, it does me. It can be very difficult to even notice that you're stressed out.
Yeah, that's why I'm stoked on this next Evo. They're CBD products, and these guys have their own patented technology, SmartSorb.
Make CBD a part of reaching your full potential with Next Evo Naturals. I mean, I'm telling you, it works for me. I suspect it would work for you.
Yeah, go check out their webpage because they got a variety of Next Evo products, you know, for less stress, better sleep, or boost your daily wellness.
Next Evo Naturals are scientifically formulated by a consumer product team with decades of experience.
Yeah, this isn't just a bunch of hippies, you know, in some barn slapping stuff together. This is tested to rigorous standards.
Only Next Evo uses Smart Sorb CBD, proven for 30 times better absorption in the first 30 minutes. If it's not absorbed, it can't help you. But Next Evo is different. It delivers 4 times better overall CBD absorption and has been proven in multiple clinical studies. Go to nextevo.com/podcast and use promo code Bigfoot to get 20% off your first order of $40 or more. That's 20% off, $40 or more at nextevo.com/podcast with the code Bigfoot. Why don't we go to the next voicemail?
Hey guys, this is Connie calling from Illinois, and I apologize if you've had this question before. So I'm wondering if you guys think that there's a breeding season for Bigfoots, or if they can reproduce any time of year like humans. Secondarily, I'm wondering what you think the gestation period might be for a mother carrying a baby Bigfoot, and what you think the average size of a baby Bigfoot would be when it's born. Thanks, guys.
Huh. Well, I think all of those questions might be answered best with, we don't know, but we have some thoughts. It turns out that I don't think any ape really has a breeding season. I know that some come into reception, so to speak, periodically, but I don't think there's like, you know, between September and December is when this particular ape species gets it on. I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's a matter of when particular females might be receptive. And so I don't think that there would be a breeding season for Sasquatches, although one would have to consider what would be, considering, you know, Sasquatches live in a much harsher environment in some ways, as far as like temperature and all that sort of stuff, than the other apes that we know of, the extant apes. So you'd have to kind of wonder, when is the most opportune season for a newborn Sasquatch to be born? I think that would probably, I'm guessing that. I don't know. What do you think about that, Bobes? I would think at the very end of winter would probably be the best time for them to be born, because they could survive on their mother's milk for a month or a couple months and then start eating other types of food. And that's, and of course, in spring is when more of those foods would be available. Do you have any thoughts on that? That's what it feels like to me, at least, like late winter, early spring, because that's the beginning of the fruitful time for the rest of the year. And they could always survive on mother's milk, which that probably has a high fat content. And Sasquatches don't seem to have too much trouble getting food, no matter what the season. That's my thought. What do you think?
The two birth stories I heard about them were like late spring, but I don't know if they're, you know, that's just what I was told.
Right. Well, yeah. So apparently apes have a gestation period of about 8 or 9 months or so on. I mean, like I just did a quick search here. So bonobos, 240 days, chimpanzees, 243 days, you know? So it's not that much of a big difference here, you know? So let's just say 8 or 9 months, maybe 10, if you know, for whatever reason, say 9 months, like humans, give or take a little bit. So 9 months before, I don't know, March, maybe that's a good time to be born, because things start melting away. But then again, more northerly climates, maybe that's a little bit later. And as far as the size, well, ape babies tend to be very, very small. And I'd say about the same size as a human baby, although human babies have bigger heads than all the other ape species when they're born. So that has something to do with it as well, I suppose. But yeah, so tiny little things. I mean, they're not like, you know, kangaroo babies or something. They're like human babies. Maybe a little smaller, maybe a little bigger, somewhere in there. Probably a smaller head proportionally to the size of the body, because of the smaller brain case there. Gestation period is probably about 9 months. And breeding season, probably not. Apes don't breed yearly. Really, no ape does. I mean, chimpanzees, for example, they breed every 1 to 5 years. I think for orangutans, it's like something once every 6 years. I could be wrong about that, but yeah, there's this period of time where they don't have babies because they have to raise the baby they already have. humans could be an exception. You know, we could keep pumping them out yearly if you really wanted to. But at the same time, the other ape species just don't do it that way because they have a baby they have to take care of already. And that's probably very demanding on their resources.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think it would be a seasonal sort of thing. In my head, at least, you know. But again, I think Bigfoots are pretty good at this sort of stuff and pretty good at staying alive and finding food and having the resources they need and whatever. So they probably don't need to be strategic in that sort of way, other than perhaps missing the depths of winter when the food would be by far the most scarce.
I'll go with that.
Well, okay. You second that motion. If Bobo agrees with me, I must be right.
As everyone says.
Yeah, exactly. Bobo knows. All right. Well, Connie, I hope that answers your question. But again, even if it doesn't, we talked about it for a while.
So there you go.
There you go. Why don't we have the next question, and we can talk about that one for a while.
Hi, Cliff and Bobo. I met a young man who lives in Sumatra who claims to see orang pendeks every day. And I suggested to him that he pull some hair to try and get DNA. I couldn't think of anything better. What are your thoughts? Love the show.
Well, thank you, whoever you are. We appreciate that you love the show. How about a photograph? That would be I think that's a good way to go, because based on my time in Sumatra, most people down there have cell phones, which I found very astonishing, by the way. The little side paragraph here. I'm hiking, right? I'm going to Gunung Tujuh, which is that lake that I paddled across and backpacked into in Sumatra, like 5 miles uphill. And, you know, it's also a place where, like, young people go for regular hikes and stuff. It was kind of cool. And even at the top up there, you know, 5 miles in, there's a bunch of teenagers, 16, 17-year-olds with cell phones. And I'm thinking, these people living in Sumatra, you know, and out hiking me, and I've got hiking boots, and they're wearing flip-flops and stuff, just shaming me, essentially. These young people, and they're taking pictures with us because they don't see Adam Davies and I sat down with a bunch, and we have a bunch of pictures with these folks from Sumatra taking pictures with us because we looked unusual to them, you know, so they were taking pictures and they were astonished. They all have cell phones. Are they paying $200 a month?
Oh, the rates were nothing. It was like, yeah, it was unlimited everything, talk, text, all this and that for like $8.
And they were getting reception.
Yeah.
They're getting reception in the depths of Sumatra and this tiger preserve on the top. And I'm thinking something is wrong. Something is wrong with us, because we think that this is an acceptable thing to get crappy reception and have to pay so much money for it. I don't understand. But anyway, let's get back to the question. Sorry. Orang pendeks. Grabbing a hair off a wild ape might be very difficult and dangerous. So if this orang pendek that this person is claiming to see, which I kind of doubt. I mean, you know, orang pendeks are, I think they're absolutely real animals, of course, but they can't be more common than, say, orangutans. And even when you're in the territory of an orangutan, you don't see them every day. In fact, I read something a few years ago, and my numbers might be a little squishy, but they're approximately right. These orangutan researchers did like a 5-year study or something in an orangutan sanctuary area, not a sanctuary where they're like acclimated to humans or anything. But I think they had something like 7 or 8 sightings.
That's a lot.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't 5 years. Maybe it was 5 or 8 months or something. But still, they practically never saw these things. And I would expect the orang pendek to be about the same. But if this guy does see an orang pendek occasionally and saw that it was scratching its back or something, then yeah, hair would be cool. Hair would be really cool. But why not just start with the picture? Because this person probably has a cell phone or access to a camera. Or how about footprints? We can compare them to the other examples we have in the data set. How about footprints? I think that would be a good way to start. And, you know, plaster is relatively cheap over there. Even pictures of the footprints afterward, or pictures of the footprints in the ground, would be very telling. There's a lot of ways to approach this, but getting a hair off of a wild ape would probably be very, very dangerous. Because orang pendeks, yeah, they're called small men. Orang means man and or human, and then pendek means small, because they're short, three to five feet tall. But they're still a lot stronger than pretty much any human. You know, look at chimpanzees; they're about the same size, and they can literally rip your arm out.
Yeah.
I'd be very cautious about approaching an orang pendek. if I were this person, if he's even telling the truth. And when people tell me they see Bigfoots every day, I don't believe them. When people say they see Orang Pendex every day, I don't really believe them. Heck, if you told me you saw bears every day, I probably wouldn't believe you either. You know, even though that's much more reasonable and you could bait them and they can come in and feed on your trash and stuff, but still every day?
Yeah. Even if they say they hear them every day, I don't believe that.
Of course, people exaggerate. Maybe they hear them once a week. Maybe that's more reasonable. I don't know. They might be around a lot more. And frankly, the way these things roll, I mean, all of these unknown ape species, they're probably around a lot more than people realize.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I was talking to a long-term witness just yesterday, actually, who's a listener to the program. So hello to you. You know who you are. This gentleman was saying to me, it's like, for as often as we see them around the house or are aware of them, hear them and do all these sort of things, they must be around just so much more that we just never know about. And I think that's probably the way all of these ape species would roll, including Orang Pendex.
I can go with that.
Yeah, I think so. And again, if Bobo agrees with me, I must be right.
That's what everyone says.
Well, there you go, whoever you were, asking questions about Orang Pendex. All right, cool. Let's listen to the next question now.
Hey, Cliff Bobes, Doug here from Southwest Florida by way of Squatchachusetts. I've got a really fun question for you guys. If you guys were skeptics, now put on your skeptic hat for 5 minutes. What would your top three reasons for Bigfoot not to exist? Also, thank you for having a vastly entertaining theme song that's upbeat. Every other Bigfoot podcast has this depressing, overly dramatic intro that's, quite frankly, hard to listen to. Thanks again, guys. Appreciate all the entertainment and looking forward to your answer.
First of all, thank you for the theme song compliment. We do appreciate that. Well, I do.
Pruitt loves it.
Matt Pruitt certainly loves it because he's the one who wrote it and performed it. That was nice. But Doug from Southwest Florida by means of Squatchachusetts. Nice name drop in there, by the way. We love it when Squatchachusetts gets a call out because they're a great group. Some of the best investigators out in that part of the country and certainly the best in Massachusetts. No offense to all the other ones, but we have our favorites. But anyway, if we were skeptics, what would be that driving force? Well, I guess ignorance of the data would probably be my first one. Ignorance of the actual evidence that is coherent and congruent. That would have to be the driving factor for me personally, because I'm an evidence-based researcher. I like basing things on the evidence that I can personally weigh or can understand and wrap my head around. So I would have to have ignored or been unaware of the evidence, particularly the footprint cast evidence and the other casts like handprints and that sort of thing. Yeah, so I think that would have to be the driving factor. I think the media wouldn't help at all either, because the media, what they put out there all the time are the hoaxes and the dubious encounters. Like, somebody said this, and here's a video that looks very, very fake. You know, that the very, very fake part would be in parentheses there, because they don't show a lot of the good stuff that's out there. They just show the stuff that looks ridiculous. So the hoaxes and the bad press and the bad logic of, since there are hoaxes, everything is a hoax, which is what most skeptic books go to. The skeptic books love to point out the Ivan Marks stuff or these other busted hoaxes and say, and as if that's proof for all of the sightings and footprints and photographs and videos and eyewitness encounters. All those have to be fake because these one or two things are fake. It seems to me like bad logic. It's like saying that these one or two people are total assholes, therefore all people are assholes. Or these one or two people are saints, and therefore all people are saints. You know, that's the same logic. It doesn't make any sense. So for me, I guess that's what it would have to be. What about you, Bobo?
That there's not one in a zoo.
You think that would be the thing? Like that they haven't, that we don't have a body, like, which is the thing that all skeptics can hang their hat on.
Yeah,
it is the kind of the thing behind it all, which is perplexing for us people who are in the know. Like, we know Bigfoots are real, and why isn't this that? Why has this not been done yet? And there are good reasons for it. But at the end of the day, it could have been done. It could have been done several times. People have killed these things.
Yeah,
it's just unfortunate no one ever did the follow through on it.
Amen.
Amen.
I guess, but yeah, knowing they're real, it's like I don't spend much time worrying about what's the best thing for them not being there.
Yeah, it is an interesting question, though, because it gets us out of our own mindset, which is always a good exercise.
True, true. What's our next question?
I don't know yet. We'll see.
Hey, Cliff and Bobo. This is Andy Easton in London, England. I wondered what your thoughts were on how many different species or subspecies of Bigfoot there are in North America. Cheers, guys.
Oh, I love when we get listeners from the UK or anywhere outside the US. Not that we don't love the US, of course, but like to know that we have an international reach is a humbling thing. It's kind of.
Dude, nice. I just saw we charted in Albania, India.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Well, welcome to all of our listeners, no matter where you are on this planet or elsewhere. That's really cool. Really appreciate that. But as far as the question goes, number of subspecies of Sasquatches in North America. He said that, so we have to address that. So what do you think, Bobo?
Well, I mean, the footprint, unless some of those three-toed tracks turn out to be, you know, real or something, but all the footprint data points to there as being one.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's one. I think there's one species here in North America, and probably the same species in throughout South America as well. That's my guess. Could be wrong with the South America thing because things do diverge over time. But if these things have only been in North America for maybe 15 or 20 or even 50,000 years, that may not be enough time for a lot of evolution to happen as far as subspecies and stuff. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But yeah, I would say there's one in North America. Just because people report different colors of the animals or different temperaments or behaviors of the animals, those things do not make a new species. The species thing is kind of based on what can interbreed, from what I understand, like the technical definition of species. But, you know, Bobo and I are the same species, you know, theoretically. And we look and act very different, you know, but that doesn't make a new species. So I would say there's one in North America. But let's expand on this question. What about worldwide, Bobo? What do you think?
Well, I think worldwide, there's got to be, at least, you know, like six.
Okay, so what do you think they are? So it's a Sasquatch, right?
Sasquatch, and then like the brown jacks down in Australia. Then you got the Homo floresiensis. Was it Lihoa or Liho?
Yeah, from Flores. Now, I think those are the same. I think Homo floresiensis is that species. I can't remember the name off the top of my head that Dr. Forth talked about. Yeah, I think the brown jacks are relict Homo floresiensis. And that's probably the Ibugogo, because, you know, the Ibugogo is on the west side of Flores, and then the Liho or whatever that was is on the east side of Flores. It's probably the same thing. Flores is a small place.
Yeah, it's not big, that's for sure.
Now, Dr. Forth might disagree with me, but that's just my gut feeling. I don't have a lot of evidence for that, but it's a small, I do have evidence that it's a small island, but I don't have evidence that there would be the same thing or not. But I bet you the Ibugogo and the other one are the same one.
The Otang seems to be something totally different.
Yeah, my money for the Otang is it's another Australopithecine of some sort.
That seems like one people would argue the least about what it would be.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, what about the Yeren?
I think they're a different thing.
Really? Just because, like, in the same way that, let's say, black bear, American black bears and sun bears are different, or what do you think? And none of us know, so this is all just speculation, of course, but.
A lot of it's going off like native descriptions and stuff like that and how they act. The people around there all report them as being like an animal. Like none of them report them being like a wild person.
Now, keep in mind, now you're basing that on an indigenous perspective, right? To some degree, the indigenous people that you've spoken to. Now, something that it occurred to me a while back and is that the people of North America had nothing else to compare them to. Except for they look human-like and they're covered in hair, right? So they're wild people or that sort of stuff, a wild tribe or something. But the people in South America, they have monkeys. And remember how the indigenous people of South America described, one of them at least described to us, the Sasquatch that here, or the Mapinguari that they saw, was it was like a monkey but with no tail. And I'm wondering if the reason that they're so anthropomorphized in North America is because there was nothing else to compare them to. But in China there are. There are monkeys in China.
That's a great point, Cliff.
It could very well be true. And I don't mean any disrespect to any indigenous people who hold that belief that are listening and want to go with their tribal and cultural knowledge, which is totally fine with me. But I'm wondering if that's the case, because there are no monkeys in North America. Well, I mean, maybe in Central America or somewhere, but not up here in like Canada, for example, or whatever. could that be why the indigenous people here recognize, oh, that's a human-shaped thing, and therefore ascribed them as being more human-like? Food for thought. Food for thought.
That was, I'm choking on a cliff. It gave me a pretty big bite.
Oh, good. Good. That's the least I can do. And it, you know what? I know the Heimlich. Now, what about the one? No, now, obviously, Orang Pendex would be another. Because if the footprint stuff I have is real, that's not a Homo floresiensis. That's some sort of a probably terrestrial small version of the orangutan or something like that. Who knows?
Right. Yeah, I think those are definitely different. Yeah. So there's at least five. Four to eight would be, I think you'd be safe in saying something like that.
Yeah. See, I would say Sasquatch. Yeah, for sure. And I'm going to go as far as to say Sasquatch is ranged North and South America and for a big portion of Asia. So I'm going to say, subspecies, I don't know. I don't even know what that, I know there's definitions for that, but I'm not exactly sure where the cutting line is, like the cutoff line is. So I'm just going to go with Sasquatches, North and South America, Eastern Asia, and that's Vietnam, that's China, that's Russia for a lot of it. And I also think that they extend into Indonesia, like Sulawesi has reports of like 3 meter tall, like Sasquatch things, and also into Australia. And I'm even going to say that Sasquatch is probably range into the Himalayas and are responsible for one of the types of Yetis that are commonly reported. But on top of that, we have the little guys, Ibogogo, the brown jacks in Australia, that one on east in the east side of Flores. I think that's probably another one. And then we have Orang Pendex. And I'm wondering now if Orang Pendex come in two sizes, like there's two subspecies there, because most of the ones are about 3 to 5 feet tall, but there's another one called Orangadang that almost never gets mentioned. It has one mention, I believe, in Sanderson's book. There's one book written with them in the title, but it doesn't really have anything to do with them particularly. It has mostly, it's like a travelogue more than anything else. But almost nobody mentions these things. Orangadang. That they're from a different part of Sumatra. Orang, of course, means man in Indonesian. And gadang in this case means big. So like the opposite of an Orang Pendek, small man, it's the big man. And these things are about 5 or 6 feet tall. I would just normally group that into the Sasquatch category, except that their foot structure is different. They have an abducted helix. And I know that because I have a very small number of footprint casts from them. In fact, I have one trackway. Because remember, I sponsored the Orang Pendek project, and when my guys went to a different part of Sumatra, this is Dali and those guys down in Sumatra, they went to a different part of Sumatra. They came back with something that they'd never heard of. They said the locals call them Orangadangs, and here's four casts from the same trackway. And these particular casts are astonishing. They're so cool. Everyone's different than the last. The toes are in different places, and it shows a lot of flexibility in their feet with an abducted helix. It's really, really interesting stuff. And then we didn't even mention the Almas or the Almasty.
Right.
So there's those things too. So what did I just say? Sasquatches, the Orang Pendex, which might also be Orangadangs, just a different size of them. Brown jacks, and all those little guys, and Almasties. And then there's probably some stuff in Africa that we have no idea about except for the Otang. So that's five. I've got five. Yeah, I'm willing to say five is a safe number. And there might be many more, but five is a good number to start with.
Yeah, I can live with that.
All right. We've come to some sort of agreement. If we can do this, why can't world leaders do this?
We're talking about way more important stuff here.
Seriously.
Stay tuned for more Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. We'll be right back after these messages.
Let's go to the next question.
Good afternoon, Cliff, Bobo, and Matt. Little Dave from South Alabama again. Hope everything's going wonderful for y'all's new year. I just finished a book called Lower Alabama Bigfoot. The author took a trip to Falk, Arkansas that he talked about in the book and actually met Smokey Crabtree at his house. My question for you is, in the book, he claimed that Smokey showed him his collection of stuff and decided that he was such a cool guy that he took him back in the barn. And in the barn, he said he looked at a body that Smokey Crabtree had Now, in his words, he said it looked more like a cat missing a head but laid out on its back. Just wondering, since y'all knew Smokey Crabtree and Lyle Blackburn so well, is there any validation to this story? And if so, what was it? Thank you very much, guys, and love the podcast.
Yeah, he showed a few people that body out there in the freezer. What was it, a tiger, right?
No, I think it was a lion. I think it was actually a lion that he got a hold of somehow. So your friend there is correct that it was, in fact, a big cat. But yeah, it is in fact a cat. I remember him touting that around, and I remember Dr. Meldrum talking about that at one point. Smokey was a big personality. I never met the man. I wish I did. But did you meet Smokey?
No.
Oh yeah, yeah. I know when we were filming in Fauk, he was towards the end of his life, and he was too ill to meet with us that day. But yeah. Yeah, Smokey Crabtree was quite the character in a lot of ways. Everything that he did or said should always be looked at through skepticals. Doesn't mean he's lying or hoaxing. It just means be skeptical and be open to whatever you find. But yeah, there was a lion body at some point that he had, and I don't know why he had a lion. I don't know how he got a lion. I mean, it's illegal to have a lion or even a lion body for that matter, I believe. So I don't know how he got it or what the story is behind that. But I do remember when that was circulating at the time. So yeah, your friend is correct. That was a cat. But would you remember anything else about it or anything? Or you do remember that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I never saw it. But I mean, I saw photos of it. And it was a large cat. Smokey is the one guy that could like BS stuff and not get booted out of the community.
It's like a superpower.
Yeah, it wasn't like he was, you know... Oh, he faked it. He's out. You know, he's like, oh, that was just Smokey. You know, he got it. Oh, that's Smokey. So he always just got the free pass because he was a cool guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He, again, an amazing storyteller and quite the personality. So, but I'll tell you, I wish I would have met Smokey Crabtree, but a lot of my friends had the opportunity to do so. So I can just live through them, I guess. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Dave from Southern Alabama, you are correct. Cat body was not a Sasquatch. I don't know if I have anything else to add on that one. So why don't we just go to the next question?
Hey, Cliff and Bobo. This is Ryan from South Carolina. Love the podcast. Always looking forward to the next episode every week. So my question has to do with vocal recognition in Sasquatches. I would say for the most part that humans can recognize other human voices. And my question is in particularly with howls. Do you think that Sasquatches in any way can differentiate between a human mimicking a howl and another Sasquatch howling? Also, do you think there's any Sasquatches in Francis Marion National Forest? Have a great day, guys, and looking forward to the next episode.
Yeah, we always talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. I do think Sasquatches can recognize each other. I wonder how much they can differentiate between humans and Sasquatches. Maybe there's some hidden frequencies in their calls that we don't have in ours. It's entirely possible. I don't know. But at the same time, they do call back to us sometimes. Maybe just the dumb ones call back. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I always thought.
Maybe this is the dumb people call to them, though, too, which is us.
Right.
Yeah, like, oh, we think we're going to fool them. And we're just like, no. Maybe it's a lack of intelligence on both sides of that communication.
We must sound different to him. I mean, especially the last 15 years, you know, whatever, since the Finding Bigfoot came out and people are doing calls all over the place. They don't answer back like they used to. Before, it used to be pretty easy, not easy, but they would answer back way more pre-show because there wasn't a lot of people doing it. Now some people have done it. I think they're a lot more cautious about what they respond to.
Yeah, it's entirely possible they can tell the difference. And again, there might be hidden frequencies in there. Maybe we just have a different sound timbre to our sounds, you know. When a real Sasquatch calls back, I can definitely tell it's not a human. And there are other times that, you know, they're probably real Sasquatches calling back and it sounds like a human. But then you have to just say, well, could there possibly be a human over there? And if the answer is no, then it's probably a Sasquatch. But there are some times where you're going, holy crap, that is not a human being. And so that's got to be the case for them too, maybe, I guess. But I'm interested in that. What B. Mills was talking about is identifying individual Sasquatches by their sounds as well. Just because, you know, if you hear Bobo's voice, you know it's Bobo. Bottom line, just imagine if you hear my voice, you know it's me. And B thinks that she is now differentiating between the various Sasquatches that are calling back in her research area in Southeast Ohio. I think that's an interesting thing, an interesting pursuit for sure. I think identifying individuals is a very important thing to do if we're going to learn their habits. I'm trying to do that with footprints because audio is not really my thing. But I would encourage people who love audio to try to differentiate individuals from the same area. That'd be kind of a neat study. And as far as Francis Marion's National Forest, yes, there are Sasquatches there. That's one of the places that we did our investigations when we were in South Carolina, just north of Charleston there. It seems that most of the Sasquatch reports were based either in Francis Marion National Forest or way up there in the other corner, kind of north of like by Greenville and Anderson and all that stuff in South Carolina. Those are the places where the most Sasquatch reports come out of. And those are also the two places in South Carolina that have the largest population of bears. And I think that's very telling. Yeah, I don't remember what it was so long ago. I know that we spent a couple hours in the lab of a biologist or something in South Carolina, and we were kind of overlaying sighting reports and bear populations, and they corresponded very, very nicely. And that was something that impressed the professor at the college. I don't remember the gentleman's name, but I remember spending some time with him. I hope that helps you there. That was, I think, Ryan. Ryan was that guy's name. So thank you, Ryan, for listening, and thank you for the question. We appreciate it. We're going to go to the next question now.
Hey, guys, this is Brandon from North Louisiana. I'm a longtime listener, first-time voicemailer. I'm a hunter here in North Louisiana, but I'm also a Bigfoot enthusiast. And the more I learn about these animals, I'm beginning to wonder if some of the noises that I'm hearing on our hunting lease might not be coincidence. I've heard everything from what could be a tree knock. I've had trees fall over while I'm out there, either hunting or doing work on the lease. What would you recommend the first step to take to find out if these animals are actually on our hunting lease? I appreciate you guys. Thanks.
Well, Cliff's not in a strict stick structures, but that, to me, that would be a good sign.
So what would they look for?
You know, like the twisted snap trees, like 5 to 10 feet in the air. If any of those like torn off branches that are stuck in the ground making X's, or like they make those delta or chevron signs on the ground with multiple sticks.
Okay. And what else do you think this gentleman can do to figure out if they're Sasquatches?
Do some vocalizations to see what you get back in the evening time.
Yeah, I would do knocks. And part of the reason I would do knocks is because of what we were just talking about with this previous caller. Maybe they can tell the difference. But a knock is a knock is a knock. It'd be difficult to discern what's making it from 100 yards away.
People always ask me, what's the best amount of knocks to do? And I'm like, because one's the most common that you hear from them. But when I always do like one, you're never sure, like, if they're like busy doing something, like they catch the, you know, like if they barely hear it, they're like, wait, was that one? And then they only hear one. They don't hear another one. Like, whereas if you do two or three, if you catch them, like by the second or third one, they could be paying attention a lot better and hear it.
I've thought about that as well. And you know what I've started doing, Bobo, is I do one and then I wait a minute or two and do another. And I just kind of do it periodically for a while.
Right.
Because to me, one knock is the very least amount of information after zero information that you can give them to try to figure out if you're a human or a Sasquatch. And that's not much to go on. It always reminds me, I remember in chemistry class at Millikan High School, Mr. Wilshire, the chemistry teacher, told us like the simplest way to write a he was explaining why they did this, why scientists did this. When you're multiplying two numbers, they don't want to put the X for multiplying because that looks like a variable. So the simplest way to do it, because multiplication is so common, is that they put a dot, just a dot, because it's the simplest thing. It's literally the simplest thing you can write. And that's how I view knocks, as a dot on a piece of paper, essentially. It's the least amount of information you can give that still is meaningful in some way. That's my feeling. But you know what I would do, Brandon from Northern Louisiana, is I would get an audio recorder and bring that out with you and just have it running the entire time you're out there. They don't make noise, at least that's stuff that we can hear. You can always have it on you. And when you hear these noises, maybe there's a pattern to them. Maybe you can start recording them. Maybe you're going to hear a vocalization of some sort or an animal that you can't identify. You can share that with somebody and maybe they can identify it as a coyote, or maybe they can identify it as something else, or maybe they go, oh my God, I don't know what that is. sounds like a person or something like that, even though you know there are no people there, then we're on to something. So I would look to start gathering information with an audio recorder, and you don't need anything fancy. You know, one of these audio recorders that cost about $100, you know, because everybody has $100 if you want to save a few months or something. For those who are, you know, may not have it on hand, you can save $20 a month and have one in half a year. That's pretty good, right? And I try to get the cheaper ones. I don't spend $400 or $500 on audio recorders because they're going to get wet, they're going to get dirty, they're going to get ruined eventually. So I buy the less expensive ones, the ones that range between $80 and $120, because they work just fine. And get digital ones and bring that out with you. Maybe you're going to get lucky. Maybe you're going to hear something and get it recorded, because that's always cool. It's just cool if nothing else. It's a lot of fun. Something else I would do to find out if there are Sasquatches on your hunting lease or near your hunting lease is look for reports from the area. Sasquatches are really good, it seems, at finding the land where very few people go, and they gravitate towards those areas. If you can find two or three or four, or gosh, even more sighting reports within 5 miles of your hunting lease, you can be pretty sure that there are Sasquatches there at least sometimes. At least that's my thought.
Yep.
So I don't know if you have anything else to add to that, but that's what I would do. So I would start by trying to gather data for yourself with an audio recorder or something. Take pictures of whatever and see if you can find footprints, of course, but that would be a pretty dead giveaway if you can find some footprints. But look for sighting reports in the data sets that are out there, the BFRO or various other places online. If you have a couple sighting reports within a few miles of that spot, you can be pretty sure that they're on the hunting lease at least at sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you got to spend a little, yeah, you said $100. Yeah, you can get a good recorder. I would like to get one of those ones that the ornithologist was saying to get, because then they're so easy to scan through and there's way quicker to review.
Yeah. But, you know, the ones that are just left out there, the long duration recorders, like and the kind that they're used from ornithology and whatever, you got to spend the time to go through that. They have certain software that helps you, but you can use Sonic Visualizer. That's a free program that shows you the spectrograph and to kind of look for the things that are out of the ordinary. That's how we go through our the LDR stuff, long duration recorders at the NABC. Tom Shea's partner, Dusty Ruth, has donated a number of LDRs to the NABC, and we have them deployed out in various areas. Collect them about once every month or once every 6 weeks. And then while my guys are on the clock or I'm at the shop or something, we go through all the audio recorders and look for the signatures of things making noises. It takes about 20 minutes, maybe about 15, 20 minutes to go through one night, 10 to 20 minutes. So you have to spend some time doing it. But it's a good way to find vocalizations that you would have missed because you're not there. Okay, we're nearing the end of the program right now. We have a couple more voicemails that we could get to, but you know what? We're going to save those till next time. But because there's a written question. We haven't done any written questions this entire episode so far, but there is one written question that we just cannot ignore. So we're going to go ahead and attack that one now. And here it is, Bobo. This one comes from Lucy Shipley, and she asks, Cliff, you said ages ago you were open to sonnets. Sonnets. So it feels like the right time to send you one. Oh, seekers after truth and after light, with footprint casts and heat detecting scopes from steamy swamp to rocky mountain heights, they track the beast with ne'er decreasing hopes. Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Oma, many named ancestral human, just a pile of woo? An ancient creature, never to be tamed. No better trackers could they have than you. Cliff and Bobo, of whom we are so fond, proud listeners of Bigfoot and beyond. Very nice. That was awesome. That was really cool, Lucy. Really appreciate that. That was very sweet of you.
Yeah. What's the difference between a poet and a poem and a sonnet, Cliff?
I don't know. I think a sonnet is a particular genre.
I could tell you, Cliff.
Lay it on me, Bubs. You're far more artistically inclined than I am.
A sonnet is a poem of 14 lines using any number of formal rhyme schemes, in English typically having 10 syllables per line.
10 syllables a line? So that is kind of like a haiku, because haikus are traditionally 5 syllables, 7 syllables, and then 5 more. Oh, that's interesting.
keep those sonnets coming in, people.
Yeah, yeah. Feel free to write us poetry. That's something that we haven't begged for before. Yeah, if you're out there and you are artistically, actually, let's just open it up, man. If you guys are artistically inclined in any direction, feel free to do something for us, and we'll play it or sing it or say it or hum it or show it on the air or in our membership section. You know, that'd be kind of cool. Like, you, some people send us art. I mean, you know, Bobo, I don't know if last time you were at the museum, but there was a, we have a piece of art hanging up in our bathroom at the NABC depicting you and I.
I've not seen that.
And actually, Bobo, I forgot to tell you this, but earlier in the week, I finally went to my PO box in Sandy, and a guy named Mark is a fan of the show, and he's this amazing silversmith. He a few years ago, I think it was a few years ago, he sent me, you know, like my little Murphy Bigfoot silhouette thing. Yeah, he sent me one of those holding a guitar. You know, it made out of silver that he made in a necklace. And it was just so amazing. I can't possibly wear it. It's actually on display in the NABC and in the lit case there. He made you one. He made you
no
one.
Way.
Yeah. You have a silver necklace from a gentleman named Mark. I don't want to say last name, so Mark, I know you're listening. So, and Bobo didn't know about this because I forgot to tell him until now, but this is a good time to tell him. Yeah, there's a Sasquatch. Do you want to know about it, or should you just wait to see it? Should I tell you?
Tell me.
Yeah, I should tell you because nobody else may be able to see this. It's a necklace with a Sasquatch holding a surfboard, and the theme is the Sasquatch that stole Bobo's surfboard. It is at the shop right now, but you said you're coming up in the next couple of months, right?
At some point.
Okay, I'll just hold it for you. There's a couple other things at the shop that people send me to give to you. They probably don't realize that we're not like the Scooby-Doo gang where we all live in the same house or something. But I'm more than happy to save these things and set them aside because I know I see you every once in a while. Although it has been a while now since I've seen you in person. I will say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been far too long.
Or maybe you can bring it down when you go to that funeral.
Oh, that's true. Maybe I'll just throw it in the car and bring it down. Yeah, because that's only a month away now. But anyway, yeah, Mark has a fantastic piece of jewelry for you. It's really, really cool. It's just beautiful. The guy is so skilled. Yeah, it was fantastic. But the rest of you guys, whatever skills you have, maybe you want to whittle something for us. I don't know. I think whittling is an art that hasn't been featured very heavily lately in modern America. So yeah, maybe there's something you want to make for Bigfoot and Beyond, or for Bobo, or for me, or Matt Pruitt for that matter. Maybe you want to make a song about Bigfoot and Beyond and send it to us. We'll play it, man.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, and it's totally cool because, you know, the world's a mess. You may have noticed the world's a mess. And I think one of the best things any of us can do to get through all this and kind of bring everybody together is to make art, is to create, and let your inner angel fly, so to speak, because no matter what kind of art you are making, it's going to be fantastic. There you go. So there's another Q&A for you, everybody. We really appreciate you listening. If you have a question that you would like to ask us, or even a comment, you can contact us at BigfootAndBeyondPodcast.com. That's the website. And just go to the contact button. You can leave us a voicemail, as you've been hearing this entire episode, or you can type in your question if you don't feel comfortable doing that, which we totally understand. Then maybe your question will be chosen on next month's Bigfoot and Beyond Q&A. We do that every single month. And now we're going to go do our membership Q&A because we have a membership. You probably know about it. We do talk about it a fair amount. It's $5 a month. If you want to help support the podcast, you too can become a member. We sometimes talk about things on the air that has a visual components. So we post, you know, the picture, the whatever it is, on the Bigfoot and Beyond membership section and Patreon. That's where we put this stuff out. So maybe you want to become a member. And if you are a member or you want to become a member, what you get is an extra of probably 40 minutes, 45 minutes of content every single week. And this week, that extra content will be a Q&A, and all the questions come just from the members. So if you want that extra attention from us, that's a great way to get it. So go to BigfootAndBeyondPodcast.com, and then you can follow the links to the membership section, or you can always click the link in the show notes below or to the side or wherever they happen to live on your device right now. So let's go do the membership Q&A, Bobes. And in the meantime, let's go ahead and take us out of the regular episode.
Okay, folks, thanks for joining us for this month's episode of Question and Answers. The Q&A, we get a lot of good feedback on that. So give us a good rating online, review us, please. Thank you. And until next week, y'all keep it squatchy.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Bigfoot and Beyond. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe to Bigfoot and Beyond wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Bigfoot and Beyond Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Bigfoot and Beyond, that's an N in the middle, and tweet us your thoughts and questions with the hashtag Bigfoot and Beyond.